Welcome to another science show on Cambridge 105. Today's programme is entirely about sweet things. We speak to one of Cambridgeshire's beekeepers to find out about honey and how bees work. After that, we get an insight into chocolate and how it's made by a local chocolatier. This is the Science Show on Cambridge 105, the community radio in your city. It normally starts with a hello from me, Roger Frost.
And hello from me, Chris Creese, as we bring you 30 minutes of nifty science they never told us about in school, especially when it happens here in Cambridge.
Let's get right on with today's topic. Later, we'll talk with Cheryl Brighty, who hand makes chocolates in Newmarket Town Centre. But first, we're going to find out lots about bees and honey. I think you'll be intrigued. It was by chance that I met Steve Poyser give a talk at a village event. He keeps hundreds of thousands of bees, and so I went to see him.
I'm a hobby beekeeper who, for various reasons, have ended up keeping up to 20 hives of bees for my own personal use, and then the surplus honey is disposed of. But I have become a member of the Cambridge Beekeepers Association and have been for 30 years, and have past been secretary, chairman, show secretary.
Now, you're going to help fill in some gaps in my education about bees.
Well, the first thing to understand is the bees, in that there is only one species of honeybee within the UK, but there are over 20 types of bumblebee and over 200 sorts of solitary bee. So we're dealing with only one specific insect, the honeybee.
First question that comes to mind, what is honey?
Honey is a collection of nectars which the bees will collect, take back to the hive. They do not collect honey, they collect nectar from the flowers, which is basically a bribe given by the flowers to enable the bees to come to pollinate the flowers. And the act of pollination is a byproduct of the bees robbing the flowers of the nectar. They bring that nectar back. It will have a water content of between 30% and 90%, depending on the different flowers. The bees have to then evaporate the moisture out of that, which they do within the hive, to get it down to 20% or below in order for it to become honey. They cannot store it above 20% moisture, otherwise it will ferment. So they have to reduce the moisture content down. And depending on what flowers they've been feeding on, that's how you arrive at different honeys with colour, flavour, aroma, texture, speed of setting. All of that is dictated by the bees. The honey itself is a combination of sugars, once they have done the processing, with about 79% sugar of different sorts, and this is fructose, dextrose, sucrose, and other bits and pieces. There is only about 3% of other things within the honey which actually makes the difference between different flavours. The vast majority of it is exactly the same.
Oh.
And you cannot artificially make honey. You can only have honey from honeybees, because the process of them evaporating the moisture out, they absorb some honey within to their, what they call a honey stomach, and then they pass it backwards and forwards between bees, regurgitating it and evaporating the moisture away, adding amino acids and other things from within themselves. That is what will create the honey.
Okay, is it a product of digestion of some kind?
It's not digestion. No, they never actually digest it. They have effectively a series of stomachs, and they hold it in the first stomach and can regurgitate it. If it goes beyond the first stomach, then they will consume the honey and use it as fuel for themselves, or they have the ability, having eaten some honey, to effectively decide, I'm not going to use it as fuel, I'm going to make wax. And they will convert that honey into beeswax and exude particles of beeswax from special glands, which they're then able to make into their comb. So honey can, by a single insect, either be used as fuel or be converted into beeswax.
Goodness me. So the beeswax is a converted product.
Converted honey within the bee. And it takes them between 5 and 7 pounds of honey to make a pound of beeswax.
That's the most expensive bit.
That is, yes, if you're a beekeeper trying to produce honey, then you try to recycle as much wax as possible within the beehive by extracting the honey, leaving the cells virtually intact so that when they go back in, the bees can refill them with honey but they don't have to rebuild all the wax cells.
Because that's going to cost,
you a lot of production, yes. And time and effort by the bees, because it takes them a lot of time as well to actually make beeswax. Because it's not just one bee that makes it, there will be hundreds all clustered together trying to generate enough heat to exude these particles of beeswax from one another, and then with their mouth and their front legs and head parts they will be able to manipulate these into hexagonal cells, all of which are identical, all of which slightly slope downhill to a centre spine. They are diagonally and horizontally slightly offset from the ones the other side of the frame, so that they all interlock at the bottom to give the strength to hold the weight of the honey when it's in the cells.
It must be awesome to think how this comes together.
Yes, the conception of sort of humans trying to do something equivalent is very difficult to understand, because obviously they're not writing down things, there's no foreman, there are no computers involved, and yet all of these bees will be working several inches apart in the dark, producing identical cells of wax, all of which interlock together with no blueprint.
Okay. Tell me about the exploration for honey.
Honeybees will fly up to a mile and a half in any direction from the hive, so a 3 mile diameter circle from the hive, that is their collecting range, that's their normal range. When a bee goes off, it goes off usually having been told by the other bees what to go and collect, and that's all done by bee dances within the hive.
Mm-hmm.
So it goes off with a known direction to collect a product, and that product is often nectar. It will bring the nectar back, and then it will regurgitate that into the hive so that the other bees can then work it, and off it will go backwards and forwards. Because a honeybee, when it hatches during the spring and summer, lives for about 6 weeks. The first 3 weeks it's in the hive, doing hive duties, cleaning, making wax, processing honey, feeding the young bees. It's only for the last 3 weeks of its life it flies. And in those 3 weeks, it's actually flying basically flat out, backwards and forwards, weather permitting, collecting either nectar, pollen, water, or propolis. Those are the four things the bees will collect. One bee in its lifetime will collect enough nectar to process to be made into approximately 1/12 of a teaspoonful of honey.
Wow.
So if people see a honeybee and they try to revive it because it's looking a bit dopey or a bit lost, then actually it's a cost negative if they're feeding it more than 1/12 of a teaspoonful of honey, because it's going to have consumed or wasted more than that than it could possibly have collected in its life.
This is bee negative equity.
It is. Similarly, the distances involved, one bee flying a mile and a half in each direction to collect this nectar.
Mm-hmm.
If one bee collected all of the nectar to produce one jar of honey, that's a pound of honey, it would have to fly the equivalent of 43,000 miles just to collect enough nectar to produce one jar of honey. Similarly, it would have to visit approximately 2 million flowers.
So the whole thing works on scale, does it not?
It works on scale in the sheer number of bees. In a colony in the spring, there will be maybe 10,000 worker bees. By the time we get to midsummer, there could be 50 or 60,000 in there. In one hive, yes. Or one colony if it lives in somebody's roof. As I say, approximately 30,000 of those will be flying in and out, collecting these products that they bring back to the hive.
Is there such a thing as a wild hive?
There are feral colonies of bees where there is a wild colony of honeybees, often in people's roofs or in their outhouses or in holes in trees. The problems that beekeepers and bees have had over the last 10 years have resulted in there, certainly in Cambridgeshire, being no truly feral colonies of bees left. All of them will have died out over that period of time. And what will have happened is that people will perceive that there is still a colony of bees in their roof, but actually a swarm will have come from a beekeeper and will have taken up residence where the old colony has died out. So they will still see bees going in and out of their chimney, saying the bees are still there. But in truth, the colony that was there has died out, and then after a period of time, then a new swarm will have taken up residence because of the Varroa parasite, which has caused decimation within the bees. And if they're not treated for, then that's where the feral colonies will fall down and decline. And every 3 years or so, any feral colony, if it's not maintained by a beekeeper, will disappear.
Goodness. Each bee seems to know where its home is, does it not?
They do. As I say, the first 3 weeks of their life, they're in the hive. They will then start to do exploratory flights, and they will fly from the hive. You will see them hovering in front of the hive, and my perception is that they are building a map of where their hive is. And gradually, the distance they fly from the hive becomes greater. so that they can then work their way back to the hive. All of their flying is done in relation to the sun. So the messages they pass to one another within the hive is they are telling other bees to fly in a certain direction in relation to the sun, and they will be telling them how far to fly. And this is all given in the waggle dance, which the bees do in the dark in the hive on a vertical face of a frame. So they give all this information out, the bee builds up the map of where it is, and it then flies backwards and forwards. So they do develop a homing instinct as to where they're coming back to. And the rule for beekeepers is that you move a hive either less than 3 feet or more than 3 miles. You move it less than 3 feet so that if you move it just a couple of feet, when the bee comes back, having flown from where it was, it will come back, realise the hive is not there, but it's so close that actually the chemical scents coming out of the hive will attract it in, and it will just believe it's made a slight mistake as to where it's coming back to. If you move it more than 3 miles, when the bee leaves the hive, the mile and a half it flies will not then cross over onto the map it's already built, so it will be developing a new map. So it won't be going back to where it originally came from. If you moved it from one side of a garden to another, or a half a mile away, the bees would leave in the morning from the new location, but then whilst they're out, they will then come back to where they used to come from, on the other side of the garden. So at that point, you would end up with a lot of angry bees on one side of the garden with no home, because as far as they're concerned, they've lost their home, so they would become very agitated, whereas the hive sitting on the other side of the garden, bees would be leaving it but not coming back to it. Only the ones that are just starting to fly would be building up a new map based on that location. So if you want to move a beehive across from one side of a garden to another, you either have to do it in stages over a matter of a couple of weeks, or you have to move them 3 miles away, leave them at least 4 weeks so all the flying bees die, then bring them back, and then they'll be okay.
And is there a time of day when they're all in the hive?
Yes, they tend to need a minimum of 12 degrees to fly properly, centigrade, so usually late evening is the best time. So if you're moving a colony of bees, you wait until the evening because that's when they'll all be in.
Okay. Now, you said that you had several hives, so they never get mixed up and go back to the wrong house?
Very rarely. If you have all the beehives in a straight row, you end up with what's called drifting, where if there's a prevailing wind from left to right, then gradually all the bees on the right end of the row of bees will have fewer bees in them, and the one at the extreme left, because the bees will gradually drift across to the one next door, because if they're all in a row. The reason that they're allowed to drift is that if a bee comes back loaded with a product that it's collected, then it will be accepted into a hive. If it comes back empty, it's not accepted in, because each colony has different pheromones and different chemical smells within them, so they know which are the true bees coming back to the hive. And that's why when wasps are trying to get in, they will be defended and pushed out in the autumn, because they don't smell of the colony. But once a wasp is in, it can then become sort of covered in the smell of the colony, so it can then quite happily fly backwards and forwards, and it's accepted as a bee.
Goodness me. They say they're social. What does that mean in this?
Well, they are social in that a colony will consist, if we take it as being the middle of the summer, there will be one queen, and there will be perhaps 200 or 300 drones, which are the males, and there could be 50,000 workers. All of those workers are working for the benefit of the colony. They are not working for the benefit of themselves. They are a social insect. And bearing in mind they only live for 6 weeks, all of the nectar they will collect and the honey they will make is actually for the benefit of the colony to survive the winter. It's not for their own benefit. So they are collecting all of this, whether they know it or not, but they won't be alive to actually consume the honey when it comes to the autumn and the winter.
Actually, a lot of people would say bees are pretty antisocial because they come into our barbecues and they make us all scared.
Honeybees generally are more inquisitive than antisocial. They don't tend to like people. There is no benefit in them coming near people. They are really either inquisitive because you have a scent that smells like a bee or smells like a flower. So you can be attracted either by detergents, shampoos, scents, or even just clothes. So that will attract a bee, and they will be inquisitive. It is very, very rare for a bee to be aggressive unless you are actually doing something to the colony or they are upset for some reason. They don't like thunderstorms, so they can become aggressive if that's a situation. And you never place a beehive in close proximity to an electrical cable, either underground or overhead, because the magnetic forces of those agitate the bees, and they don't like them.
You've observed this.
It is well known, yes. You do not put beehives either under pylons or under overhead cables, or certainly on top of underground cables.
Well, I can buy all kinds of honey. I can buy the white honey, I can buy the clear honey. Clarify what... there's a word. Clarify the difference between the two.
Right. All honey will set eventually, just as a result of the nature of the sugar content of it. So oilseed rape honey will set within a week of the fields going from yellow to green, and it will set solid in the hive to such a degree that the bees won't even be able to eat it without them fetching water to dilute it. Lime honey will take maybe 4 years to set, and it takes a very long time to crystallise. The beekeeper will usually take off the honey from the hive and will then store it and allow it to set. That first set tends to produce quite coarse crystals of sugar. Then the beekeeper will warm it up to a degree and to liquefy it, and will then either process it by filtering and putting it into jars and selling it as liquid honey, or they will blend it with a honey that has already set, and that is what produces what you call the white honey, which is creamed honey, where the sugar crystals that you have already allowed to set, you blend at a rate of about 10% of those to 90% of liquid honey, which then stimulates all of the whole of that honey by mixing that very thoroughly to set to the same consistency of the seeded crystals that you put in. That's how you end up with a margarine type spread of set honey. Similarly, those crystals can be melted down, so by merely warming that jar of honey up, it will go back to liquid honey, and it will be impossible to tell it from a jar of liquid honey next to it.
Goodness me. You said ageing had something to do with the setting.
Yes.
The stuff in the shop doesn't seem to turn from browny liquid to white creamy, does it?
No, it will eventually, and there's nothing wrong with it. It is a natural process, and it's actually a sign of quality where it starts to granulate. People will perceive that a jar of liquid honey that suddenly got what looks like bits of grit and granules at the bottom of it or halfway up the jar, it must be going off. No, it's actually a sign of quality, those sugar crystals just growing in the honey. In order to liquefy it again, you just warm it up slightly and it will go back to a liquid state, and away you go again. So there is no need to actually throw honey away that has started to crystallise.
What is the benchmark of good honey?
All honey will taste differently depending on what the flowers are. Personally, I like the light, what I would call aromatic, flowery honey, which tends to be quite light in colour. Other people like very dark honey, which can be ivy or one of the sort of more tree-based honeys as opposed to flowers. So they will produce a darker honey, which tends to be thicker, stronger in flavour, very pungent, and you don't need much of it to significantly impart that flavour through the whole of the product you're trying to eat, whereas the more floral honeys you would.
You brought to mind a programme the other week about the commercial hives where people take lorries and train loads of beehives to certain parts of California,
yes,
to pollinate the almond crops and so on, and off to Florida to do the citrus. Does that exist in this country?
Nothing to the same degree. The problems that the American beekeepers have had, which they have classified as colony collapse disorder, has not been experienced within the UK. It is thought, particularly by British beekeepers, to be as a result of the significant distances, thousands of miles, these bees are transported, and perhaps 300 or 400 hives of bees on one lorry, all taken to one location, and then placed in the middle of almond groves, wider in scope than the 1.5 miles the bees can fly. So the only thing the bees can feed on are almonds. Almonds produce very little nectar. So in order to keep the bees alive, they are actually fed sugar syrup at the same time as only collecting a single pollen from the almonds, because there's very little nectar. So if a bee is transported thousands of miles, placed with hundreds of other colonies in close proximity, fed a single food with only artificial sugar syrup, then they wonder why their bees are stressed. Stress is one of the things that will kill bees. They've also now got the varroa mite in America, so that's also causing them issues. All of these things, unfortunately, have resulted, we believe as beekeepers, or I do, that this is what had actually caused the problems within America. We do not have the same problems within the UK.
Who's doing research on this kind of thing?
The Americans are doing a lot of research, of course, because almonds are huge in America. People who have bee hives over there have said that my father kept bees and took them to the almonds. We never had the same problem. The difference was that in those days, the Americans also imported a huge amount of macadamia nuts, and the American government took a decision to subsidize the Californian almond growing. Huge areas were put down to almonds, and now there is nothing but almonds for miles and miles, whereas beekeepers could, in 30 years ago, have taken their bees to almonds, which may have been the only thing for a quarter of a mile, but actually there were still other things nearby. Mm. Now, anything other than an almond has been killed off. No weeds, no vegetation, it's just almonds as far as you can see. Now they have a problem.
Steve, that is fascinating. Thank you very much.
That was Steve Poyser. You can find out more about this from the Cambridgeshire Beekeepers Association. Their website is www.cbka.org.uk. And if you run a community group, you might like to invite them to one of your events.
You're listening to The Science Show on Cambridge 105.
And so now to chocolate. While chemistry experts feel that crude oil is one of the world's most versatile materials, I'm going to put forward the idea that chocolate is a pretty useful second. What would we be without chocolate? Well, we'd probably be thinner. And in the interest of gaining most definitely enjoyable knowledge, Science Show reporter Nicola Terry visited a chocolate specialist. You're going to hear about the really good chocolate made by Cheryl Brighty in Newmarket Town Centre. Cheryl Brighty turned herself into a mail-order business that goes by the name of Artistry in Cocoa. Nicola spoke with Cheryl about making chocolate.
Well, chocolate grows on trees. It grows around the equator, and the trees produce a tiny flower that's pollinated by the sort of midge that would bite you, and then they turn into pods, and they get quite large.
We've got one Cheryl's got to show me, and it's a bit bigger than my hand. It's sort of a brown gourd, and you can hear it rattle.
You can. This is a dried pod from Ecuador, and when it's split open, you can see the beans inside. In this one, they're arranged in sort of around a central, what's known as a placenta. And then if you have a fresh one, as you see in this picture.
A pea pod. All the beans are white. They're covered in something that's white.
Yes, I tend to call it gloop, but it's not gloop. It's actually the fruit, I suppose, because the beans are the seed. So it's like a fleshy, a bit like what you would find inside a lychee or a breadfruit. And it's that white pulp that's responsible for creating the flavour in the beans.
So do we eat that pulp then?
It is edible, but we don't normally. What happens is the pods are split open and the beans are put on hessian or leaves on the floor in the country where it's grown, and the pulp will ferment due to the microbes in the air and on people's hands and machetes.
Just because they're in the air? Like is it ambic beer or something?
Yes, it is. Or sourdough. And that is creating your flavour of chocolate. Occasionally it goes wrong and you get the flavour of blue cheese. I've had blue cheese before. Looked perfect, smelt perfect, chocolate taste of blue cheese. But normally they get it right, and it can be anything from 2 to sort of 6 days.
And what happens then?
The next part in the process is actually roasting them, a bit like roasting coffee. And you can bring out another sort of 300 different flavours from roasting your beans.
Depending on the temperature and...
Yes, how long, how hot you roast it for. It's also actually a plant that's affected like wine by the soil and the climate and the variety. And then you actually take the papery husk off the outside. There's a bit here. And the inside, once it's roasted, goes a very dark brown. It's much darker. And that will then be chopped up and then ground.
So, and what do you do after that?
Well, when it's ground, it will be ground finer and finer and finer to produce the cocoa liquor, it's called. Once it's ground enough, it will actually liquefy because the friction will make the cocoa butter in it melt.
You're going to show me that process now?
Here I've got some cocoa nibs, which are roasted cocoa beans that have been chopped up, and we're going to grind them up in a spice mill. Now, it does take quite a long time. Is it all right? And as the cocoa nibs are getting finer, they start to warm up with the friction as well, and you'll start getting the cocoa butter starting to melt.
I can smell chocolate. This isn't the way you normally make chocolate, is it?
Most of the time we work with couverture, which is already, someone's already done this to it. Well, let's have a look. It's just starting to melt. It's getting a bit more solid here. We need to give it a good stir in again. This has got to get to almost a sludge, really.
Eventually, we got a satisfactory sludge. But it was hard work for the spice grinder. Commercially, this is done by massive machinery, of course, and the chocolate is ground down even finer than icing sugar. And then we proceeded to the next stage, which is called conching. And it involves yet more grinding, this time in a large granite pestle and mortar.
The process was invented by Mr. Lint, who you've probably heard of, and it's called conching because his original equipment was in the shape of a conch shell. And the idea is the friction keeps the chocolate melted, and it also evaporates off any of the more bitter compounds that are more heat sensitive. I'm just scraping it off the vessel now.
So what's the next stage then?
Well, you would get this a little bit warmer and melt it, and you would temper it. And that's how you control the crystallisation of the cocoa butter, because it's the cocoa butter that makes it set.
And what's the stuff that isn't the cocoa butter?
It's the cocoa solids. The cocoa solids that have the taste.
So this cocoa butter is going to crystallise?
Yes.
Right, Cheryl now has a bowl of chocolate from a previous occasion in a plastic bowl, which we're going to melt in the microwave just to show the tempering process. So why do we have to control the crystallisation? Crystals are crystals.
Well, this particular crystal, cocoa butter, is a polymorphic crystal, which means that it has different shapes. And the different shapes, although it's the same substance, affect the physical properties. So the different shapes will melt at different temperatures and they will set slightly differently. And it's been discovered that the beta form, which is the form that we need, is the one when it sets that will give you a nice gloss to your chocolate, that will make it shrink when it sets, so it will pop out the mould, which is very convenient. It also makes it more heat stable, and it gives it a nice snap when you get a bar and you break it. It will snap rather than just sort of crumble.
What's the difference in melting point between the different forms of crystals?
Not a huge amount. We're only talking a couple of degrees. So we've got our melted bowl of chocolate, and the chocolate itself is actually fairly thin. I'm going to pour about two-thirds of it onto my cold surface, which in this instance is granite. It could be marble. And I'm going to start moving it around with my scraper, which is a bit like a glorified wallpaper scraper. I start moving it around in sort of a circular sort of figure of eight movement, just to spread it out and allow it to cool and move at the same time. It's very important to include all the chocolate in the movement. And as you can probably see, if I hold it up, it's starting to get a bit thicker. I'm going to just put it back into the bowl now, which is slightly warmer. So while I'm moving it around, I am speeding up the crystal growing process, and I am making all the crystal shapes. Now I'm going to put it back into my bowl, and I'm going to get a knife and give it a really good stir. The idea is that the chocolate that was left in the bowl is a bit warmer than the chocolate that I've just put in. And if we have hit it right, then it will melt out the crystals that I don't want, because my stable crystal has a melting temperature of about 34. And the idea is the chocolate in the bowl comes up to about 32, which is known as working temperature. So now I've got a thicker chocolate, and I'm going to put it on my cold surface, just in a thin layer, spread it with a knife, and hopefully we will get that set in about 3 minutes. And if it's nice and glossy and not streaky, then we know we've got the right crystal.
So now that this chocolate is melted and it's got the right kind of crystals in, what happens now?
At this point, you can pour it into a mould to make bars or filled chocolates, or you could actually get a centre and, for example, if you hand rolled a truffle, and then you could dip that into the chocolate to coat it. There's also another technique which I don't use called enrobing, where the object to be coated goes on a conveyor belt and then this sort of chocolate is poured over it to create a shell.
Nicola Terry was talking to Cheryl Brighty of Artistry in Cocoa. Listeners can find out more by going to the website artistryincoco.co.uk. And that's pretty much all for today's Science Show on Cambridge 105.
You can now pick up our podcasts on iTunes. Just search for 105 Science. Our next live show on Cambridge 105 will be in 2 weeks.
Meanwhile, if you have a science event to promote or a question to inundate us with, you can email us on science@cambridge105.fm.
And that leaves us to say many thanks and bye from me, Chris Creese.
And bye from me, Roger Frost.